Keeping Democracy Alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So, yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Smokestack lightning. Do women have unique power to stop wars? Is there something related to the gender? I don't know. I wonder about that. We'll find out about that. Is this idea naive or is it realistic? It's usually men who start wars and who fight in them. Is there something about strong femininity or feminism that has power, unique power, to challenge and change the power of machismo, having to look manly, and instead bring peace? Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is the longest-lasting international women's peace organization. It's celebrating its 100th anniversary in many places around the U.S. and at The Hague in Holland from April 22nd to April 29th, 2015. Our guest today is Robin Lloyd, a peace activist and filmmaker who has served on the WILPF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, board on and off since the inspiring experience of producing a documentary on the peace train to Beijing and the Fourth World Conference on Women in 1995. First, tell us, thanks for being with us, and tell us about what that peace train was about, please.
Well, that was an extremely exciting and galvanizing experience for all of us in WILF to go from Helsinki, Finland, all the way to China for, what was it, I think it was 10 days, with women from all different countries, and then stopping in a number of cities in the former Soviet Union and in Central Europe that had just been several years out of change of government and the fall of the Berlin Wall. So we would stop and meet with people all along the way, and being privileged to be the filmmaker of the experience that 40 hours of footage, I was able to live with it for the next year and really...
you got to
really
know it.
Sort of in, take it into relive it and cut it down into 1 hour. So we're going to be showing that here at the Commission on the Status of Women, which is dedicated to looking at what came out of Beijing, which is the Beijing Platform for Action. And has it been implemented? If not, why? And if so, where? And so there are just women from everywhere talking about that subject here this week in New York.
Well, I want to go back, 100 years. How did the WILF, as you say, that's easier to say than Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, how did that get started in 1915 in the middle of that incredibly horrible Great War, which we now know as the First World War? How did WILF get started?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and I have been researching that for the last year or so because my grandmother was one of the people who became galvanized to cross the Atlantic to join other women to offer ideas of mediation and to go to foreign capitals to say, hey guys, how about considering these ideas? How about stopping? How about having an armistice? How about having mediation? But so I was so interested to to try to follow the trajectory of her life back then in 1914 when Gavrilo Princip first fired, fired the gun, to the 9 months later where my grandmother Lola took the boat to Europe to try to stop the war, because she was not an anti-war activist in 1914. I mean, very few people in the U.S. were even aware that there were storm clouds in, in Europe. And yet, in her case, living in Chicago, it was meeting with a Hungarian activist, a Hungarian feminist named Rozika Schwimmer, who was touring the country saying that that the United States should, and President Wilson should offer mediation, because if not, the United States would somehow get drawn into the war. And of course, she was ultimately right, but she was such a charismatic speaker that in Chicago, my grandmother met her. They went together to talk to Jane Addams, and of course, Jane Addams was perhaps the most prominent woman in America, offering a kind of feminist analysis of society through Hull House and her work in social work in Hull House. So from there, they went to Washington, D.C. and formed the Women's Peace Party. Now, there was division in the ranks of the former suffragettes or suffrage activists, because some did not want to speak out against war because they knew that would perhaps offend the men in Congress from whom they wanted to get, you know, they wanted to get the vote. So that was very controversial amongst women in 1914 and 15 as to whether to really be active to try to stop the war. But there were, but it turned out there were 47 women from the United States that took a boat at a dangerous time when, you know, the Germans had submarines that were shooting down
the
boats.
Lusitania.
The Lusitania was was hit just a week or so after the Wilf conference happened.
My goodness.
In April 28th, 1915. So they did that. They met with the women, and that became the founding moment of Wilf. We didn't call ourselves Wilf at that time. It was, I forget the title we gave ourselves for the next 4 years of the war, but in 1919, we took on that formal name, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, because one of the commitments made in 1915 was that the women would reunite at the end of the war, hopefully to be in the same town and able to be heard or make their voices heard to the people negotiating the peace settlement. Well, that didn't happen because the conference, the Versailles conference, took place in France, and France would not give any visas to German women to come to take part in the Wilf conference, so the conference had to take place in Zurich. But Wilf was one of the first organizations to critique the Versailles Treaty. That was, in a sense, what our founding action back in 1919.
And if you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, our guest today is Robin Lloyd of Wilf, Women International League for Peace and Freedom, on their 100th anniversary, what it started out as and what they're up to now. And 1915, it would have been a perfect time. And it is useful talking about what could have been. It really is, because we can, hopefully must, learn from history. Wilson was dedicated to people in their own countries creating their own future. And unfortunately, by participating in the war itself and the disastrous events of the Versailles Treaty in 1919, that was not to be. But there was an opportunity to make an armistice at least, and to prevent the Second World War. If there had been a decent peace after the First World War, there would not have been a Second World War. That's absolutely known for sure. And it's tough to be ahead of your time and to be prescient, but certainly Wilf was. You were about to say, Robin.
Yes, well, if they had stopped to look at some of the causes of World War One and Germany's feeling of being, in a sense, surrounded and not having its own source of energy or of fuel, mm-hmm. because one of the factors, and this came out in the play that we have produced called Talking with Our Grandmothers.
Yes.
Let me just tell you a bit about that.
Oh, please do, yes.
Which is that a friend of mine, it turns out her grandmother graduated from Smith College in exactly the same year as my grandmother, 1897. My grandmother went on to be involved in trying to stop World War One. Her grandmother was stationed in Turkey, which was a nation that was wooed by different sides.
Yes.
Had lots of resources that everyone wanted and was standing on top of the crumbling Ottoman Empire.
Right.
And so my friend's story about her grandmother as contrasted to my grandmother is very interesting and opens up a whole side of World War One that most people are not aware of, which was that Germany had negotiated a Berlin to Baghdad railroad that would cut all the way through to Turkey and then on to Baghdad, and that this was going to be develop their source of oil
mm-hmm.
through that railroad, and that Russia was very upset with that,
oh,
and
yes.
of course England and France also, so that, as it worked out, Turkey took the side of Germany mm-hmm. and England and France declared war on Turkey, but the United States never did. We sort of maintained a foothold there so that when it came time to divide the spoils after World War One, we were in a favorable position to negotiate a share of the oil. And what happened in the Middle East as a result of the World yeah. War One is still with us today.
Absolutely.
The Sykes-Picot Treaty where France and England sort of drew a line in the sand.
Yes, literally. Yes.
Jordan and everything. Those decisions, you could say that the ISIS people are saying, well, you colonial powers made decisions back there during the so-called Great War that we had no say in, and why should we observe the borders that you laid down on us?
And it's interesting, just a few weeks ago, there was an ISIS video where they had a bulldozer and it went right through the Sykes-Picot line. So World War One never ended. It's we're paying such a high price to this very day, 100 years later. So this performance piece that you did, what's the title of that? And so
it's Talking with Our Grandmothers. In fact, we have a website that devoted to it. World War One Women's Peace Movement.
Wow.
Which describes the piece, as well as some background on Rosika Schwimmer and the women that were in The Hague in 1915. And we keep wanting to add more material, but it's the first time I've really been in charge of a website. It's a responsibility.
I haven't a clue how one would do that. Not one of my skills. I have some skills. That ain't one of them, for sure. So, that performance piece is available at, what was the website again?
Yes, WW1 Women's Peace Movement.
Well, I'll have to check that out.
And or talking with our grandmothers. It's part of it if you Google either one or both. And so we videotaped last night's performance, and we want to use it to promote Wilf and the 100th anniversary, which is actually in April, April 28th in The Hague. I mean, you know what was happening 100 years ago on April 28th?
Yes, I do.
The women were gathering, and 104 miles away was one of the most...
how to describe it?
Horrible. Battles. It was in Ypres,
I think it's called.
Ypres, yeah.
I think it is.
Which, of course, it had battles here and there and backwards and forwards, but on that date was the first time that Germany really succeeded in using chlorine gas effectively. Mm-hmm. They had tried it out, and of course the other side had tried it out too, but they, you know, they had the advantage of slightly higher land, the wind was blowing properly, and, you know, thousands of people were dying just 104 miles away when the women met.
Yes.
And the sort of the burden of the realization of this war so close to them when they were conferring and having to confer in a huge hall with no microphones or simultaneous translators. I mean, it must have been an extraordinarily intense situation. And the moderator for the whole thing was Jane Addams, and apparently she did an incredible job in sort of moving the resolutions forward and listening to people from all different countries that were at war, whose fathers and brothers were fighting each other at that time.
Mm.
So this was really, it's an event that really should be remembered and held up as an example of the kind of the reason why women, peace, and security, which has become a resolution passed by the Security Council in the year 2000, which incorporates some of the ideas from way back at the beginning of Wilf, that women, peace, and security needs to be implemented. Women at the peace table is really our mantra. Now that only 5% of the signatories on peace settlements that are overseen by the United Nations are women, and that this is not good.
You know, I laugh, but it's horrible. And that Battle of Ypres, you know, this the gas that was used. I mean, the First World War. I think most people don't really know a lot about it. But it's, as I said before, it's the context for it, the struggles. Many of them are still going on today. People are still dying as a result of that. And to have that knowledge and that commitment by the women who went to the conference on April 28th, 1915. You're right. A lot more people should know about that. How many women participated in that? Do you know about?
There were 1,200.
Wow.
And they came from 12 countries. Many of them were Dutch. They were. It was in their country, so they turned out en masse. But there was German, British, though some of the British delegates were kept from arriving. I think there was just one woman from France. There was, one woman from Armenia, and again, that was a country and a group of people that right at that time were being massacred by the
Turks,
in April of 1915.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these very horrific events were sort of hanging over the heads of the women as they met there.
Unbelievable.
And just to tell you, one of the sidelines of the play is that because I was able to read my grandmother's papers in the Schwimmer Lloyd collection, which is at the New York Public Library.
Oh, good.
So I was able to sort of follow day by day what happened while they were there. And they waited around to go to plan their trips to the different world capitals to talk to the leaders. And in her diary, she says, "Well, we went out to see the tulips." So I ask her, I'm speaking to the bust of my grandmother, and I ask her, "Well, how could you go see the tulips when people are dying so close and you have the burden of all of this violence around you?" And she says, "Well, you know that outside of Boston, the women textile workers said, we want
bread and roses.
Work and roses too."
Right.
"Well, we in The Hague are saying we want peace and tulips too." So so we tried to kind of tell the story in a creative way of what it was like to be there.
Wow. Quite a juxtaposition. I can imagine, you know, really feeling what that was like to know that this incredible bloodshed, mindless bloodshed, was going on, mm-hmm. and these beautiful tulips everywhere.
Yeah.
There's so much to talk about here and to follow up on. I read a wonderful book by Adam Hochschild. I don't know if you've read it, called To End All Wars. There were some amazing women in Great Britain at the time. Alice Wheeldon paid a very high price in terms of going to jail. There was Sylvia Pankhurst, Charlotte Despard, and Emily Hobhouse. Those were among the women that were written about there. They paid a high price in terms of public scorn, at least in terms of public scorn, if not actual jail time. Mm-hmm. I believe they're remembered differently today, and they're remembered in a very positive light. Do you have any information mm-hmm. about that?
Well, I don't really know. I did read the book, but I didn't really follow up on how they're remembered today. But, I mean, for example, Jane Addams,
yes,
when she came back, she continued to speak, but as soon as the U.S. entered the war, the public opinion changed against her and against the peace efforts that she had been involved in.
Right.
In fact, she was severely maligned for having said that in Europe she heard that the soldiers were often given alcohol before going out on the battlefield.
Yes. That's a fact.
Relieve their fears,
right,
and to help them overcome the transgression of killing somebody.
Yes.
And she talked about that as she was on a speaking tour, and that turned against her, the fact that she seemed to be putting down the soldiers. And this was even before we entered the war, so it wasn't that she was criticizing American soldiers. And so there was that kind of attitude developed, and as we entered the war, it became more and more difficult to be peace activist or to have take a position of conscientious objection. And that was another interesting thing we did last night at the event here, to a sort of prequel to celebrating the 100th in The Hague
mm-hmm.
in April, was that we invited the groups that were born out of the same cataclysm as we were, not only WILF, but the Fellowship of Reconciliation. Mm. Some of your listeners may know about that organization. That's 100 years old, last year and
mm-hmm.
this year.
Mm.
And that's a group of more of clergy people and religiously focused people who at that time were concerned, just about the violence, but also about the individuals that were being
vilified,
forced to enlist and didn't want to take a position of conscientious objection. Also, War Resisters League.
Oh, really?
Although it came together formally in the 20s, it got its start giving advice to young men who did not want to fight. And the American Civil Liberties Union and the American Friends Service Committee all got their start back then, as well as a number of other groups that haven't lasted to this day. But those four groups and Wilf are still with us and still doing good work. And so we wanted to have a sort of sisterly time together last night at our celebration, and it was very nice that several of them were able to be with us.
And it's amazing how so much of where we are today in 2015 is very much related to the events of 100 years ago. It's mm-hmm. it's absolutely still going on. So there was the 100th anniversary of Wilf on March 11th. What was that like? It must have been rather invigorating.
Well, it was. We had the Raging Grannies to start with.
I love that name.
They're always full of pep, but they had created a special song for the 100th. We had our play, Talking with Our Grandmothers, and then we had Madeline Rees, who is our Secretary General, at the For Wilf, that's what she's called, Executive Director maybe in other books, but she's a excellent spokesperson for Wilf, and she came to us from the United Nations, where she worked in Bosnia and was part of a group of women and police women who discovered that the peacekeepers in Bosnia were transporting women across borders to brothels, that they were involved in human trafficking.
Oh, my.
And she blew the whistle, and that became a film called The Whistleblower, which I don't, some might have seen. It's a fictionalized version of the discovery that the peacekeepers were involved in this. And Madeline Rees's role is played by the British actress. I just had her name on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, it's a wonderful performance, and I think it's available on Netflix.
Oh, terrific!
So Madeline Rees has been very active in trying to implement the what we call Security Council Resolution 1325,
because
women need to be more involved in the activities to prevent war. Yes, women need to be protected during war. Men are willing to concede on that one. But women have to participate in the resolution of war and be at the peace table when there is a settlement. So she has been working with the Syrian women, and I was just hearing her today talking about the situation in the Ukraine and trying to bring women together. I mean, the groups already exist there, but they're not able to get traction internationally. I mean, there are women who are working on both sides to try to stop the violence. And we just need to hear those voices more. And I'm really thrilled at what Madeline Rees is doing.
And that Security Council Resolution 1325, that would require women participation in peace agreements, is that it, or what?
Yes, it does. It says that if the UN is overseeing the peace settlement, that women have to be at the peace table. Now, what happens is that that's not honored, that, for example, Madeline Rees got to Geneva with some of the Syrian women during the time of peace talks more than a year ago, and they were shut out from being able to be at the peace table in that instance, and despite the fact that it was overseen by the United Nations. So, I mean, countries can say, or both sides can say, well, we don't want, it's just the men with the guns that matter at a peace settlement.
I don't like that.
There's a way of looking at it the same, well, of course, because they can say, we're going to leave and go back to shooting people, so
sure.
we are the only ones that really matter.
Mm.
Whereas in terms of really crafting a settlement that is genuinely headed towards a nonviolent cooperative society, you would need to have the women who have been upholding the community while war has taken place. Can you imagine living in Aleppo right now? Aleppo,
Syria.
Syria.
Yeah.
And which has been, was a historic site for antiquities, and you know, it's not just ISIS that's purposely knocking down statues, but both sides in this war are bombing things randomly, and wonderful sites are being destroyed. But it's the women who are trying to hold together whatever community is left in these places.
And I can imagine in Gaza, places like that, women just trying to hold it together. And throughout history, women have had this unique power to end all wars. There's some kind of power that women have to be able to stand up to men that other men can't do. There's the story of Lysistrata in the Peloponnesian War. I don't know, you may be more familiar with that than I am.
Well, I remember that at the beginning of the Iraq War, there was a widespread performance of Lysistrata to help people remember how women protested war back in those days, and you know those things should be implemented more now.
I'd say, well, the story is from if I have this right, that in the Peloponnesian War, women wanted their men to stop fighting, so they said no. How should we say, intimate relations until you end the war?
Yes. Yes, definitely makes sense.
It does, and men can often be motivated by such things. And, you know, this is a WILF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. International is a word in there. And it's interesting, you know, to think about internationalism, people of all countries, which, you know, there are these lines in the sand that are drawn that separate people unrealistically and arbitrarily. And I think some of the reality is that people are people. And it doesn't matter, you know, which side of the border you're necessarily on. You know, internationalism is in direct contrast to nationalism, which rose up in the late 19th century and led directly to the First World War and is, you know, still in effect today in the very troubled Middle East. What are some of the war-related problems of the idea of nationalism, per se, that you could talk about, Robin?
Yes, well, some of us in WILF have a problem with the United Nations. Basically, our position is being very supportive, working within the United Nations and everything, but it is a union of nation states. And so we have on occasion proposed that there needs to be in the United Nations a world parliament where people would be elected directly from around the world. It's as if the United Nations needs a House of Representatives. It has a Senate. The Senate is the General Assembly, where there is a delegation from every country. But this parliament would be the people of the world.
Uh-huh.
And, it could be voluntary for a while, and then maybe it would ultimately develop more moral stature to be accepted. But that's a direction that I think we need to go, because we're feeling here at the Commission on the Status of Women, which is a remarkable gathering of women from around the world. I've attended four or five sessions every year in March. It happens. This year there are more women than ever. They're saying 8,000 women, and all trying to, some of them are able to get across and into the United Nations, but that's very limited. And so most of us are meeting here and sort of listening to each other and hearing reports on, say, women in Kazakhstan, and what are their struggles. And it's very frustrating, because we know that we can't really effectively lobby here. I mean, to think of going up to Susan Rice and saying, we think you should really, not vote for continued violence and violent solutions in Libya or and so on and so forth, is not there's no traction to it because we know that everyone here in a part of the delegation to the UN from the U.S. is their marching orders come from Obama and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the value of being here, but let me just say this because I don't want to imply that there isn't a value, though I am critical of it, is what is happening here across the street from the UN, which is that women are hearing, are talking to each other. They're learning the language of human rights.
Wow.
And they're learning what their country has agreed to officially. And when they go back to their countries, they are able to confront their governments and say, okay, you have agreed to this human rights protocol. Why? You must implement it, and we are going to be watching you. And so that's really the power, to my mind, of this gathering of women here is not so much that we can influence the United Nations right now in their deliberations, but that we will go back to our countries and be able to use these. Even, you know, I'm from Burlington, Vermont. There should be more women on the police commission.
Absolutely.
One of our arguments needs to be that the United States has committed to gender equality in various protocols, and therefore our arguments should be listened to.
Mm.
You know, so
well,
it can be brought down to the local is what I'm trying to say, from the global to the local.
Absolutely. Think globally, act locally. It's really true. And you brought up policing, and you know, clearly most police are men, not all, but right now in these currently United States, there is a great militarization of police everywhere. I'm concerned about that. I wonder if Wilf has talked about that and has concerns about the militarization of police, you know, making them into a fighting force. And obviously the enemy would be us.
Yes, yes. I mean, in Burlington, we have before the city council a resolution showing concern about that. I'm not quite sure how it's phrased, but I do know that Vermont now owns a tank.
Oh, great.
And, you know, why do we have a tank? Well, if someone's holed up with hostages in a rural area that we need to approach, and we need a tank. So, yeah, I mean, all this stuff was just left over from the war. And let me just segue to the issue of, you know, the arms trade and arms business and the corporations that are benefiting from continued war. Because in World War One,
yes,
it's now been documented that the arms makers of that time had the ear of Wilson and made lots of money. I'm thinking mainly of DuPont, for example. And one of the things that Wilf did in the 30s, when, you know, it takes a while for people to really look back and absorb what happened in such a traumatic time as World War One. But in the 30s, there were something called the Nye hearings, N-Y-E, in Congress. And Senator Nye wanted to look at how corporations benefited from World War One, and these hearings went on for months. And although it became clear that, for example, DuPont had increased its income astronomically as a result of the war, very little was done about it. And we then, you know, as the 30s proceeded, increased spending on armaments, and then there was World War Two. But what we're thinking in Wilf is that we need to have another Nye hearing. We need to look at the spending that's going on for these wars that are being fought. And now we hear that armed drones are going to be sold to some country or other. And good heavens, what are, you know, of course, only to our allies.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. But who are our allies in the Middle East right now? And
really,
could they not just flip in a year or so?
Easily.
Like poor Jordan, which is so, as a nation, sort of traumatized by
of
refugees
course.
From every country, not to speak of the fact that I think they're about half the population is Palestinian, with the concerns that Palestinians have, that these governments are not as stable as one thinks, and to think of arming them more, and especially arming the Middle East, of course, this is where the oil is. So,
and it doesn't matter. These guys are making tremendous profits, and you may know this story from the First World War, as it was dragging on. England, a belligerent against Germany, of course, desperately needed lenses for periscopes, looking up from the trenches and things like that. So there's this big drive in England for people to donate various glasses and lenses. It wasn't anywhere near enough. Well, at the same time, Germany was in desperate need of rubber. Well, England had a lot of rubber. Germany had the Zeiss Icon lenses. So guess what? As the people were killing each other, these companies traded. They got British got the German lenses, and the Germans got the British rubber, so they could keep fighting. It was tremendously profitable. I mean, can you imagine being one of the people in the trenches, the women at home? Oh my God, outrageous, absolutely outrageous. Mm-hmm. And the nature of power and the money that's involved here. People, I think most citizens are not aware of how profitable war really is.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could talk about that, about, the nature of real power. And you guys, Wilf has been at it a long time, so you have some experience as to the nature of power and the power of money. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, yes. I mean, our slogan this year is Women's Power to End War, that we need to develop and take the power to call an end to war. And One of our ways of doing that is to name the names and to shame the war makers, and that's why holding another Nye hearing would be one of the ways of doing that, to point out that of course it's all tied with Citizens United and the fact that the corporations have more power now than they ever did,
yes,
and that they're more entrenched. But I think people are waking up to all of this, don't you? I mean, there are two wonderful movements happening, sort of apart from what we've been discussing, and that is around Ferguson and police power and militarization of the police, and about the environment. I mean, I took part in this huge demonstration and march that took place
September
here in New York City a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who are not going to be buffaloed into supporting military spending, and who are articulate and are going to be on the streets.
Right.
So I'm hoping that there is a movement that we can all join together. I mean, our analysis in Wilf is that military spending is sort of underneath all of this,
yes,
and that the need for oil and the military is the major user of oil,
mm-hmm,
means that we have had to have these relationships with horrible dictatorships like Saudi Arabia. Of course, now we're producing a lot of our own oil, and as Michael Clare has written in The Nation, that may change things, and that the price of oil may stay down, and that may give different strength to different governments.
Oh, interesting.
Venezuela may have a harder time because it won't have the money to put into social welfare issues as they did have.
Money and power. It's amazing how many people die for such things.
And
yes, if you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Robin Lloyd of WILF, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, celebrating its 100th anniversary. Some powerful stuff. And we're talking about the unique power that women have. And just as not all white middle-aged men are war-making Republicans. Of course, not all women are peacemakers. I wouldn't want Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, or even Hillary Clinton making war policy. I mean, I've seen the political button that says trust women. I wouldn't trust those particular women. You must have heard such comments before. Are they not feminist enough or feminist at all? How do you respond to, you know, women power and you got women like these?
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I think that there are women who have fought their way to power in part by supporting and implementing a patriarchal view of things. But what we are hoping for is that if women obtain like 50% representation in parliaments and congresses, that will make a significant change. And I think that is true in Sweden. And in some other countries where women are, I think, between 30% and 50% of the parliament, where social services are much more paid attention to, education is a focus, and the concerns that women have as primary caregivers for children are given more attention.
What a concept. And the whole idea of national security. What is national security if we don't have roads and bridges, if we don't have schools, if people aren't eating healthy food? Well, you know, national security isn't just the big pile of weapons that there are. And I think women tend to be more in line with that. Now, you must have heard criticism over the years that, you're naive, you know, that some wars are necessary. We got these horrible ISIS people out there in World War II, the Nazis. We're not nice people. Aren't some wars necessary? And what about this charge that no doubt you've heard that Wilf may be, naive in thinking international cooperation?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wish there was a more robust debate. Of course, this is a historical question again. What if the United States had not entered into World War I?
Would have been better.
I mean, Germany, yes. All the countries were almost, you know.
Oh, it was almost
collapsing.
Over. Absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, Germany had attacked and broken a treaty with Belgium at the beginning of the war, and they seemed to have violated more human rights of more people, and the Kaiser was definitely, was implementing a strategy of aggression towards other countries. But if we had not entered the war and there had to have been some kind of settlement,
yes,
I think Germany would not have been in a in a demeaned position, which they felt. I mean, Hitler was a soldier in World War I.
Yes.
You need to remember. And one of the problems for Germany was that their soldiers fell in France. Their bodies fell in France. They never had the opportunity to get their bodies back and hold a true ceremony for them. And so Hitler called himself the unknown soldier. I mean, he didn't die, but he was sort of representing all of the soldiers that did die, and were never adequately honored. So that whole thing of resentment,
it's
have been very different. It's interesting to play that through.
And it is worthwhile to do so, to talk about what could have been.
Yeah, what could have been.
What about ISIS now? Don't we have to destroy them militarily?
Well, you know, I mean, ISIS seems to have risen up out of a terrible vacuum of our incompetence in the 10 years of war
in Iraq. Yes,
Iraq, and you know, if you have your door kicked in by troops that are either American or supported by the United States, you're sure as heck going to want to get
right.
back in some way or other. What just seems very strange, I was talking with an Egyptian woman last night where she is pointing out that that the United States position on ISIS is not is sort of ambiguous in the sense that did not support giving air power to the Iraqi army to push ISIS out of Tikrit. This happened just in the last week or so, because we said the Iraqi soldiers were being led by an Iranian general. I mean, it's, you know, things
it's
are
insanity.
Just... I don't know. They're far more chaotic and confusing than I think people are aware of, or that even the U.S. government can get a grip on.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Supposedly we have spies everywhere, right? And we're listening to everyone talk. But to understand what the motives of people are and why, for example, young people are joining ISIS.
Oh, my God,
and what
really?
The attraction is.
It's amazing to me.
Is something that I believe our government doesn't know how to counter, and you know, and of course my feeling would be, well, education and jobs, rebuilding jobs is what is needed to woo them back from that life and try to give them a future and some sort of nonviolent vision of the future.
Absolutely. You know, there's no hope. This is what happens, and you know, we don't. It does seem fairly obvious that the more ISIS is attacked, the more recruits they get, the more they fight. It's just clearly something else has to be done, and I don't know where the good ideas will come from. Maybe from Wilb. I got to ask a couple things. Young women are kind of quiet these days. They've never taken the reproductive rights issue all that seriously. Somehow they just. In general, I mean, there are some who understand that they can be taken away, but what can be done about connecting with and invigorating young women to get involved, to realize the power that they have?
Mm-hmm. Well, we ponder that a lot because it is primarily an aging organization, and some of our branches, I mean, I have to admit it, their meetings are held in nursing homes. But we do have a program that's very exciting. It's called the Practicum here at the Commission on the Status of Women. We offer to college students to come here and spend a week. We talk to them about Wilf's history, and they attend the UN as well as these parallel events that are happening here across the street. And they, you know, it's helping them be, you know, have a global perspective on the good and the bad things that are happening in the world. So, and they're going back to their colleges and
and
talking about it. But yes, I mean, I think one of our problems as a organization that's been around for 100 years is knowing how best to communicate with young women through the social media.
Right.
Now, Wilf does have a Facebook page. I just, myself, and I'm in my 70s, learned how to do Twitter.
I just figured it out a couple weeks ago.
Pardon?
I just figured it out a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. So that's one thing we have to do is meet the young women where they want to be, and attending a lot of meetings is not necessarily the way to go.
Right.
I mean, some of them are in college or holding two jobs, and
I think
they're committed to these issues, and our desire is to find out how best to reach them and empower them to speak out.
And once people feel a sense of power, it's kind of addictive. It's a good feeling. You could actually make some changes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about, but we basically run out of time. You got a manifesto, which is very, very interesting.
So glad you brought that up, because we've been working on that for like 3 years, and I read an early version, and then I just read yesterday the completed version, which will be printed and made available at the end of April. Yeah, very incredible. Where did you access it? Is it on the website, right?
Yeah, on the website. What is it? Women Stop War, something like that.
WomenStopWar.org. Yes.
WomenStopWar.org. Very, very interesting. And I encourage people to take a look at that. It makes a lot of sense. It really does. So what websites can you point out that people should go to if they want to pursue this and perhaps be invigorated and take some powerful action?
Well, that would be the main one, womenstopwar.org. Just wilf.org, WILPF, wilfus.org for what we're doing in the United States. And, in fact, we have six different issue committees within WILF on Citizens United. We call it Corporations versus Democracy.
Yes.
Armament, of course, is a big one. Food insecurity, and a few more. Advancing Human Rights. Yes,
it's some great stuff.
So,
a great platform.
We would love to have people sign up for that and take part in our monthly discussions, conference calls, and go to The Hague next April. You can find out where and how and when. We'll be in the same hall that the women were in 100 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Cool. Women will be there from especially all the frontiers of conflict and where women's rights are being diminished.
Yeah.
And we're hoping we will all be re-energized to deal with the struggles to come.
Oh, let's hope so. Thank you so much. Very, very interesting and hopeful. I like that hope and, defending democracy, and that's what we're about, keeping democracy alive. Thank you so much, Robin Lloyd of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And that's good. All right.
Thanks.
Goodbye.
Love. On and on through the years.